Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode of Masonic Effects, a place where we can have conversation on items and interests that have some bearing on the craft, craft masonry. It's a pleasure to have you joining again, and a shout out to our listeners in the Philippines and South Korea, France, and Canada, and UK, in the United States, Uganda, India, Brazil, and Austria. Yes, Austria. It's France. Did I miss anybody? I'm sort of a bit scattered here. This is the sort of the contrapoint to the Twitterverse. I know that we have had some people that picked this up on streaming after a live broadcast. And I'm sure that they're tremendously disappointed if they're looking at or expecting a typical barrage of disconnected sound bites. This is more the disappointment for all of that. It's where we have a chance to reflect and to consider, contemplate issues. Sometimes they're the type of thing that are more historical points that, when we're sitting together and discussing them, we're asking questions. And sometimes those questions have to be asked a number of times. And sometimes the answer doesn't become evident at the first instance. So sit back and enjoy. I hope you find I know we've got an interesting commentary today. So sit back and enjoy. Nothing like music from '24. Nothing like music or recording from 1924. And I'm sitting here in the midst of a whopping storm. Where I am, we get winter. And although it's spring right now, winter doesn't want to leave us just yet. Very high winds, 50 knots and 30 to 50 knots, and freezing rain, and all the the beauty of the weather has left the conversation. It's just to be tolerated, and it's this is what happens here. No complaint. It's like after this solstice, we're only about, I think, what are we, about 70 days from solstice? It's the 105th day of the year. I always find that kind of amazing that we're zooming around through the year, through the calendar, without too much regard for how much is going on around us. This is... if you're looking for a scholastic effort, this is not necessarily where you're going to have a list of answers to fed to you, but it will give you an opportunity to think through some of the questions that may have occurred to you, and hopefully and introduce you to questions not yet have gelled in your own thinking, provide not so much answers but direction. The idea of following the thinking of somebody else is rather a remarkably sign of immaturity. As well, we're doing an article that's going to be coming, one of the commentaries coming out probably May of this year, talking about that we're going to address the effects of praise, not prayer, praise. We've in the past juxtaposed that with encouragement. And we see that a little bit too often, and there's some problem with that. It should be concerning to us. It's one of those shoulds. It's like this evolution of science that's led us to a world where we have a lot of conveniences that are generated by the use of plastics. Now there's a counterpoint, as there always is. The counterpoint is what these plastic particles are doing to our environment. And it's not right. And yes, it's unhealthy. And we're going to have to collectively do something about this. And no more. Let me emphasize very clearly that in an environment that is, fracturing so quickly, that's a risk to us, to our democracies, and to the predictability of our community, is this atomization, what's called an atomization. And I think it's an easy concept to follow when we use terms like that, where the individual voice, the individual mind, the individual issue, someone takes issue with something, and systems are being measured by the responsiveness of the collective to that, to the perspective of the individual. At some point, we need to realize that that collective is community. And it is community that gives us that sense, the illusion if you're cynical, or the experience if you're a contributor to it, of predictability and security, safety of the mind. The atomization is taking us to a tipping point away from community. And in our own modest and quiet way, one of the few aspects or agencies that I have tried to search out that is a counterpoint for that effort to move us to, in a sense, separate us, and with that would never end, because we can't please the individual perspective of millions and millions of people. We couldn't, that's just not feasible. There has to, at some point, be that sacrifice, I guess, why we obey a stop sign when we're driving, because we do have vehicles that will allow us to cruise right through, but we also have a sense of common safety. And for that, we have to appeal to a bit of our judgment. We give up a little something. We may be impatient. We may have to wait in line, and we may find ourselves becoming more and more intolerant, which is a concern for all, especially for Freemasons. But Freemasonry is the expression of community. We go about our business quietly, without a lot of fanfare. And I'm talking more about the true Mason here, the true Mason, the individual who has developed an element of literacy, Masonic literacy, adding to the experience of Masonry. That's driven, that sense of literacy is driven by a curiosity. And it may well be that people come with a blunted or opaque sense of curiosity, or may feel very passive, that they can sit back on their, we can sit back on our haunches and watch the world go by and take our dipper and into the pool every so often and sip from that knowledge when it suits us. Well, the elements and pressures and gravity that's sort of swirling around us includes these things about social media that really do put tools in the hands of the people that need to express themselves and feel that they're accounted, their uniqueness is counted in the broader spectrum of our communities. But at some point, we need to make those sacrifices for the common good. For the common good and common purpose. And that's not easy. Masonry does subscribe to an idea that we need to do this, be well informed about it, and do so willingly. So when the some of the setbacks like is around listening, selecting only the news that agrees with our worldview, with our points, that becomes shockingly isolationist. If we're only, it's like talking to ourselves. We're only going to talk to that small cohort that thinks and acts just like me. No differences of opinion, no reality. The reality is everybody has their own unique opinion. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's the nature of us. The nature of you, the nature of me. Apart from that, there are certain fundamental truths. Truths that we can approach and understand through observation and examination. But you're talking here to the singing to the choir, aren't I? We're that Masonic bunch that is well aware that that we have a need to understand the science of life. So do we go about our business? At times fraught with manipulation by others, and I want to the window that I'm opening here during this discussion is about the manipulation that occurs when we respond and allow ourselves to receive praise. Yep, there's a downside to it. It's like it is, and it becomes an end in itself. It's especially praise is difficult for creative people. Definitely is. We almost become desperate for it, seek it out. It's always one of the, you just stand there in a new light, and then inevitably the light shuts off. We use language that is supercilious, you know, language, the language of everything is a hero, everything is words that don't really have much meaning. A superstar, you know, a star, a celebrity, these are words that don't really have much meaning. And the real sense of the term is what does that person do? What have they done? And is it pleasing? Is it useful? Is it understandable? Yeah. But let's set that aside for a second and collect our thoughts with some music. This is a very, very old piece of music This is when you can hear the voice. Ella Fitzgerald is in this, singing with her friend Louis Armstrong. And I just want us to be thinking about how carefree and absolutely delightful they sound, coming from a culture that condemned their very being, that condemned them for their color, for their culture. This is a culture that violated civil liberties even to this day. Listen to the audacity of these people. They were able to find something that lasts, some beauty and joy. In fact, they rose above it all. Here.
I found the man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Never again, through with love, through with men, they play a game without shame, and who's to blame? I thought I'd found a man I could trust. What a this is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
Yes, I thought I knew the wheat from the chaff. What a laugh. This is how the story ends. I let her turn me down. Say, can't we be friends? I acted like a kid out of school. What a fool. Now I see this is the end. I let her turn me down. Say, can we be friends? Oh, why should I care? Though she did for me the air. Why should I cry, have a sigh, and wonder why? Yes, I should have seen the single stop. What a flop, this is how the story ends. She's gonna turn me down, say, can we be friends?
What we know, what we suppose, and what we need to do. I won't get into the misogynistic attitudes of the estates. No need. They are self-evident. They are evidence, at best, of male chauvinism, at worst, of stupidity. To explain the process over tens of centuries, let me bring to mind the Nike Swoop. You know that brand you see on Nike football shoes and sports equipment? The artificial division of genders was and is intellectual bankruptcy. We crawled into the Renaissance not as conquering heroes, but sheep that escaped the shepherd. From a time when Italy was a cluster of principalities, Florence had become a center of imagination from the 15th century. The estates of control were forever altered by events they could neither predict nor suppress. Who knew the pushy upstart John Wycliffe would commit to translating scripture? Who could have guessed that translation would challenge 1,000 years of dominance by Roman Catholicism? And who then would guess it would put into motion influences that created the opening for a populist human movement? It was like injecting oxygen into a vacuum. Human beings thrived in a period that unleashed creativity and a freedom of the human spirit. And my God, did we experiment. The masquerade of Florence was a manifestation of liberty. What could not have happened in any, that could not have happened in any other place? Well before the Baroque and then Rococo period, the gentry of Europe and Britain began for the first time to travel for enjoyment, subscribing to a grand tour into the nightlife of risk-takers. New. Intellectually, the arts burst barriers wide open. It claimed a sensory experience that violated social restrictions, and people lined up for heretofore forbidden sensations. Taking a big historical step into 17th century Britain, we find a violent 10-year window of secular, political, and military activity. We would be disingenuous to think people literate and illiterate could not be influenced. Is it feasible to think the foundations of Freemasonry were forged by blood and suffering? Appeal today? Well, yes. That'll work. Thank you. Little homage to Django Reinhardt, wouldn't you say? Yeah. We, Carl, I want you to just do a little bit of a heads up here. If you believe, you know, this is a line of thinking that's a bit troubling in a way for me, and I think for us we have to be aware. It's about the praise that we receive. If we believe the praise, then we're letting other people control what we think about our work. And because we've become so intimately invested in our work, we're letting those people control what we think about ourselves. That's dangerous for a bunch of reasons. But the harshest, the really toxic reason is that once you've been pumped up by the praise of others, you can be squashed by their criticism. If you were buoyed by the kudos, you'd be sunk by the boos. And this involves a tug of war between the desire to be talked about and the desire to not go crazy. It's the negativity bias. It's dangerous. And think about it. Do we do things knowing that they're acceptable and making a positive contribution? Well, we don't need the praise of other people truly to validate those acts if we're listening carefully. Aude, aude, vide, tace. If we're listening carefully, and you know within your own mind whether what your tendencies are, and we all run the risk of hearing something but not listening. That nuanced conversation, or the capacity to put ourselves in the shoes of other people. The tendency, I think, is to be rash, boyish about it, a bit impetuous. Rather than taking into account and letting it swirl in the back of the mind like a nice taste of scotch or wine or an espresso or that spiced tea, you know, we savor or we miss. Now, is that to say that everybody that just drinks to slake their thirst is missing something? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We labor in the field and slaking our thirst is important. But it's not to say that we rob ourselves of those opportunities to notice things about ourselves and other people. What are they striving for? And if we are observant, their behavior will tell us the truth of their motives, more than anything that comes out of their mouths, behavior reveals. But it means we're not perched with that aggressive, aha, this isn't about the aggression or that self-congratulatory, ego-driven stuff. Aha, you know, the person that it takes their cynicism to a lifestyle where they feel that their work is to some way enriched by the criticism of others, of finding how they're right and others are wrong. Well, it's a bit foolish, yeah? Because in the human landscape, we could apply that generally. It doesn't really tell us anything. It doesn't add to the conversation. After a while, all it does is make us appear shallow. Taking it, we do have some material on Masonic effects that you know, just reflects the emotional state. And I, you know, I can't make an apology for being sort of captivated by some of these writers. And today I bring to you another piece of poem by another piece of work by Pushkin, that incredibly nuanced mind, Russian mind. I'll say that. This is his from his poem, and called "Under the Blue Skies," and that speaks for itself. Under the blue skies of her native land, she languished and began to fade, until surely there flew, without a sound, above me her young shade. But there stretches between us an uncrossable line. In vain my feelings I tried to awaken. The lips that brought the news were made of stone, and I listened like a stone unshaken. So this is she for whom my soul once burned in the tense and heavy fire, obsessed, exhausted, driven out of my mind by tenderness and desire. Where are the torments? Where is love? Alas, for the unreturning days, sweet memory, and for the poor, credulous shade, I find no lament, no tears.
No more celebrations, dawn is all done. No larger pieces, des temples là. Je crois entendre ton pas. Devant ma porte, des bruits lointains. Guettant ma porte, j'écoute un verre. Là, plus rien.
Le temps passe et court en battant.
little ditty by Jill Barber. Thanks, Jill. We've been thinking about talking about the some of the enriched topics that really are just beyond our ability to define and put in narrow boxes. This is where we can do our best work, where we can extend our imagination. We've been talking about symbolism, and lately getting into a little bit about the claims of the early historian of the Masonic organization, the Grand Lodge form as we know it, and challenging some of the veracity of the information. We know that it doesn't really hold up, and some of it was purely the result of imagination, not fact. A bit risky when we're calling it history. Just spin it, you know, put it together because we need one. Here we're unpacking some of that stuff, and what we're finding is perhaps even more interesting, more compelling than that fabrication, you know. And in itself, finding that some of this was fabricated for very practical reasons. A guy needs money. He can make money by producing everything. He gets paid by the page, so you're going to produce a lot. And if you don't have checks and balances, which he didn't at the time, you can plagiarize. I don't know if plagiarism is the real word. You can just be creative, be very economic with the truth. It's interesting to note the different uses mentioned in some of the old manuscripts, so I'm going to refer to them. For example, one of the early years of the 18th century refers to the staircase having three steps, demonstrating that the practices of masonry, which had settled down a century later, were still very much in a state of development. Once a three-degree system became established by the 1730s, the introduction of the odd number five as intermediate to three and seven may have been automatic. In the early days, there's no doubt that three was regarded as a general Masonic number. Cast your mind back. While seven related to completeness or perfection. In particular, seven, the number of perfection, became associated with the third degree, which in the middle 1700s, before the advent of the many additional degrees, was the special and perfect degree of the craft. Most of the old catechisms refer to the number required to make a full and perfect lodge, or a true and perfect lodge, or some such similar expression. The answers varied, but the use of three, five, and seven is fairly consistent, often in alternative. So, get this. This is from the Edinburgh Register House manuscript from 1696. What makes a true and perfect lodge? Seven masters, five entered apprentices. Does no less make a true and perfect lodge? Yes, five masons and three entered apprentices. Does no less, the more the merrier, the fewer the better cheer. No wrong notes, huh? No wrong notes. And it may be difficult for us to comprehend when we're sitting here with our slide rule. Some of you are old enough to, I don't know if I still have mine around. How can we be both better and more is better and fewer is better at the same time? How is that possible? Think about it. What makes a just and perfect lodge? Are we talking here about history, like the facts that are just out there? Because this is mathematics and this is esoteric. But we're coming to a different understanding today of secrecy and confidentiality. Privacy, huh? Sort of ruined a good conceit of mine when I gave up thinking that my information was private. I was being told that. And I was being told that by employers when I knew at the same instance that what they're telling me was a fabrication. It wasn't true. And now we find what? 87 million people have had their information exploited through a major Silicon Valley operation. Well, I write, but what does that information tell me? You know, I have to have some context. It's just there. So somebody sold something and made a profit, and we can always dumb down and say, oh, I just didn't see that coming, and there's no sense of responsibility in all of that, except it tends to take advantage and exploit something about you, the individual. And so we're going to weigh in on that and find out what's going on to our own satisfaction. And it really doesn't matter a damn what the experts and designers and the owners intended. That doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, it's complicated, eh? This is from a pamphlet, a Mason's Confession, from about 1727. Now remember, back in this period where we were in the forge of masonry, where we're seeing systems of ritual being developed, and that sense of privacy was much different than what we subscribe to today. Much, much different. You can ask, and do this, you can ask the newest member of your lodge to research a question and ask the most private question you can imagine. Ask the word. And measure how long, how many minutes it takes that person to find an answer, whether they're punching it out on their iPhone or having to go home, and how many minutes it takes. And then address that whole question about, as we get all muscular about it, ask that essential question of yourself about privacy and confidentiality. Oh, we gave up on that one a long time ago because we communicate. It's an ideal that we're going to sit on all this information, but my goodness, if it wasn't for what was written down, if we didn't step beyond the boundaries of oral history, a lot of what we're talking about here wouldn't be known. And we do embellish. And for times in certain pockets and certain areas, yes, for certain, for sure, information was conveyed mouth to ear. And if you've ever remember your school day experience where sitting in a circle, we whisper one secret around the group and then announce what it was at the start and what it was at the end. We know the results. Great, great fun. Great fun. No, to think that that wouldn't have happened to ritual. Are we that naive or are we trying to be kind? To suggest that numbers were merely a matter of symbolism and not necessarily followed in practice, which could be the reason for the wording in the Edinburgh Register House manuscript. The prevalence of odd numbers should be noted. The grand mystery of Freemasons discovered in 1724 gives us a reason for this. How many make a lodge? God in the square with five or seven right and perfect masons. Why do odds make a lodge? Because all odds are men's advantage. There's a revelation. What in the hell are we talking about here? The theme of odds being male is also found in other manuscripts and seems to show that the use of odd numbers where possible was symbolic that free and accepted masonry was restricted to men and that a more general use of even numbers would show feminine influence. Chauvinism rears its head? Oh, that must be because for the influence of the Catholic Church. No, that would be the more of a cultural influence. Remember the early coffee houses in Britain, women weren't allowed. They weren't encouraged. In France, it's quite different. But we want to stamp the ethnocentric cultural supremacy on this. We want to say this culture was righter than the others. These are things we're going to be, this is an indictment that is going to come to bite us. And we need to be prepared. And the way we prepare is to look at our currency. Because saying, oh, that's not what we meant, and continuing to be divisive in our comments, particularly around gender, is leaving us open to legal challenge. Oh, we're not beyond the law. We're sort of a hummingbird's wing beat away from, you know, human rights challenges. And will it matter? If it doesn't today in this moment, it's going to. It's inevitable. Not because we're talking about it, but think about it. Do the math yourself. Do the math yourself. We need to be able to have more than glib comment. It's like, you know, as profound and as ridiculous as saying our whole purpose is to make a good man better. It's glib, and yet it's profound. And what do we say about gender? Oh, no. We haven't thought that one through at all. And what do we do to build currency to put it into a broader context that we are not against? It's not like we're against. We're pushing people away from masonry, the opportunity of masonry. The conversation becomes enormously clumsy and falls apart under harsh criticism. But the theme of odds being males also, you know, this. What context do you put that in? Well, you know, that's on you. And there's plenty of justification in the Bible. Well, that's, you know, let's pull that out. When we're trying to, you know, present ourselves as an enlightened group, we need to have our theologians at the table for this one. We use these numbers. The use of these numbers is if we're looking for justification. There was a work by a fellow named Crudence called The Complete Concordance, which was available by the middle of the 18th century. And it stresses the recurrence of the number 7 in the Bible, in the King James Version, I presume. Besides, the known influence of this word is also used in Scripture as a number of perfection. 7. In the sacred books, it goes on, and in the religion of the Jews, a great number of events and mysterious circumstances are set forth in the number 7. Makes us wonder about the Kabbalah, where I feel like a child learning my sums or learning a new way of thinking I'm not shying away from it. I'm just saying I have a deep respect that I never used to. It was just too hodgepodge for me, my little mind. And then it started to unravel. Cruden then follows with reference to the creation, the Sabbath, and Jacob's 7 years for each wife. And then multiplied by 7 was celebrated as a jubilee. And Pharaoh's dream was in 7s, the branched candlestick, the 7 trumpets, and the 7 days to surround the walls of Jericho. Cruden does not give nearly the same significance to 3, although he lists nearly as many instances of biblical use as for 7, which run to almost 2 closely printed columns. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are probably the most significant historical use of 3 in the Jewish faith. My apologies to the Jewish scholars and my Jewish friends for saying that, but is it valid? As might be expected, the use of five is not so great, although it appears to have some significance in David's five stones, five loaves of bread, and Benjamin's five change of raiment. The probability is that it was a convenient bridge to three and seven. With the influence of Jewish history and the Essenes and the Kabbalists, it is of interest to note that the Encyclopedia Judaica refers especially to 3 and 7, 3 because of the inherent completeness, and 7 as having an especially important role in antiquity. In the Kabbalah, there was particularly strong use of groups of 3. Many writers have referred to the influence of the Pythagorean system on masonry, and the Jewish Encyclopedia of 1903 refers to the similarity of the Pythagorean idea of the creative powers of numbers and letters with that which is the foundation of one of the textbooks of the Kabbalah. Dr. Wynne Westcott suggests that the use of five may have come from Pythagorean influence and refer to the pentafa, or five-pointed star used in masonry, which he calls the emblem of health, the Pythagorean emblem. No, they were vegetarians. You do know that, huh? Right, just in case. Wynne Westcott also asserts that the development of the number of steps in the winding staircase probably came from a Hebrew and possibly a Kabbalah source. Note how they separate those two things. It is clear, as already mentioned, that the number of stairs was not always 15, and that this is the total of the figures 3, 5, and 7 associated with the 3 degrees. Wynne Westcott says like this: 3, 5, and 7 amount to 15, which is equivalent to JAH, God, Yod and He, and 10 and 5. Every Hebrew word is also a number and the reverse. There we go. The prejudice and bias toward our Jewish brethren wasn't obvious. Somebody had talked with the rabbis, with the theologians, and listened. There was something in it, perhaps not completely understood, but something worth the influence. Even to this day, as here we are in 2018 talking about this. And it's not meant to be easy. The important things in life, maybe we have to do all of the math to realize that the answer was in front of us all the time. And in the various lectures, versions in the times up to the Union of the Grand Lodges in 1813, there was no consistent numbering of sections as this sort of basis. When the new system, which is still used, appeared in its more or less final form in 1817, the lectures of the 3 degrees had 7, 5, and 3 sections respectively, the minimum numbers which the lectures claimed were required to form a lodge in each of those degrees. Thus, this was the first time a numerical pattern appeared in lectures, and it must have been deliberate. The Duke of Sussex was Grand Master at the time and was intensely interested not only in the reorganization of the ritual and lectures, but also in the Hebrew language and the Kabbalah. And he may have been responsible, the Duke of Sussex. The number pattern found in the Jewish religion has other important numbers. Those who were influenced by Kabbalistic and other Jewish uses appear only to have taken what suited them. Not bad. A little Charlie Parker with Coleman Hawkins. This is from 1950 recording. It's an improv. Yeah. Not to like. Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins. Sensational. We'll sign off today. I hope you've enjoyed the program. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. This is the eve of the Battle of Culloden. Not that everybody in the world would be directly affected by that. It was on the 16th of April, 1746. Oh, my ancestors and had caused a bit of trouble for the English, more than a bit of trouble, had slaughtered a lot of people. We had a political point and attitude and a belief. And so the king mounted his army. Yeah, there was a problem with the logistics near the river, blah, blah, blah. We lost. They defeated us. And on that day, because of the we were a petulant group, and from that time, the tartan was banned. It was banned from that date, 1746, until 1782. That's when George IV began wearing it. He was the acclaimed king of Scotland as well. And just a little bit of trivia, because my clan name and me, a Graham petitioned the English Parliament, leading to a vote that decriminalized the symbol of Scottish independence in Culloden. It was a Graham, and the vote was in favor of decriminalizing the wearing of the tartan. At the time, you remember, a lot of people had buried their tartans to ensure that they wouldn't be lost, and dug them out and we have some nice stories about what that did to sort of the natural dyes and things that still go on to this very day, but more of a latter day kind of a development, the wearing of the tartan in the history. And I'm glad, for one, I'm glad that it exists. With that in mind, I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us today. It's been a good time, and I'll send you out with a little more of Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins, and a thanks. Very grateful for the opportunity to have you here with us.
After the section with Coleman Hawkins and Charlie Parker, the rhythm section.